And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us for the second hour of our show today. In the month of May, nearly 10,000 unaccompanied immigrant children were caught crossing the U.S. southwestern border, a 300% jump in such captures from the same period last year. That's according to the government. These children were mostly coming from Central America, and most were fleeing a complex set of problems, including gang violence. Federal facilities used to house these children are now bursting at the seams. And so the White House has been looking for additional housing options, including here in Maryland and in Baltimore. But opposition to a plan to convert into a shelter a vacant federal complex in West Baltimore, the Metro West complex that until recently housed part of the Social Security Administration. That caused the Obama administration to scrap the idea altogether. Members of Maryland's congressional delegation were opposed to that plan, as and concerns were raised by the mayor of Baltimore as well. In this hour, we're going to be looking at the surge of these immigrant children with Linda Hartke, president and CEO of Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services. She'll be with us in just a few moments. Before we start, we want to get to a related note on immigration. This week, the future of federal immigration policy reform has been called into question following the shocking defeat of House Majority Leader Eric Cantor in the Virginia Republican primary. The conservative Cantor's loss to the even more conservative Tea Party, Dave Brad, has shaken up the Republican Party, and pundits on both sides have pointed to Cantor's stance on immigration reform as one of his downfalls, major downfalls. On the topic of immigration, Cantor had said he didn't support amnesty for undocumented immigrants, but that he did not want the children of illegal immigrants to suffer. Brett used what seemed like compromise by Cantor on this issue as a major point of attack on the campaign trail. So we're going to talk about this a little bit in the outset here. And joining me in Studio A is WYPR senior news analyst C. Frazier Smith, also, of course, columnist for The Daily Record. Frazier, nice to have you back with us.
Good to be here, Dan.
Also joining us by phone, I thought it'd be interesting to speak with Jeff Shapiro, political columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Jeff, thank you for making time for us today.
Thanks for having me.
And, you know, I yesterday there was a lot of talk about the media having missed this huge story of Eric Cantor possibly losing the primary, taking everybody by surprise. But I've pointed my listeners today and folks who follow me on Facebook to a story you had last month, May 25th, a story of pretty much describing the what seemed like mounting opposition to Cantor, at least down in Quinton in New Kent County in Virginia. So, Jeff, just tell me how big of a surprise was this for you?
Well, I think everyone, I would include myself, surprised by the outcome. Even the Brat people were not anticipating a defeat. It was clearly their intention to draw blood, embarrass Cantor, minimize him somewhat before that rest of Republican caucus in Washington, and perhaps scuttle or slow his designs on the speakership. The immigration issue, I think, was something that put in very sharp focus something about the Cantor character that discomfits people. The national press sees a lot of this up in Washington with Mr. Cantor, this constant positioning, trying to anticipate the media curve rather than pushing through or using the Republican majority to push through a substantive, policy-rich agenda. And as Cantor scaled the greasy pole of power, as his interests became, you know, much more national and certainly his ambitions grander, the distance, the figurative distance between Mr. Cantor and his constituents in Virginia grew. And I think that was complicated as well by partisan gerrymandering. This district was made to order for Eric Cantor. It was drawn to his specifications. That meant that Cantor only or largely had to rely on the Republican reflex of the district to win and hold office. He never really had to develop communication skills or never really chose to schmooze the press and take our questions head on. So he became a very aloof, removed figure particularly among the people who are his neighbors and his voters.
And in a Republican primary, and specifically, you have to play to that base. You have to work the base pretty hard. I guess he didn't feel he needed to do that.
Well, a point about Virginia primaries, unlike Maryland, Virginia voters do not register by party. So when there is a primary, it is open to anyone who is registered to vote. For the most part, partisan primaries tend to attract the most committed partisans. However, there is some evidence that Democrats turned out for this primary, not as much to vote for David Brat, but to vote against Eric Cantor.
Yeah, I've heard that. I heard that from my own brother, actually, who lives down there. How much is there to that? How much was that a factor, Jeff? Can you say today?
It is more of a curiosity than I think a finding. Characteristic of this outcome, The turnout was about 6 or 7% in a district with about 400,000 voters, or a little bit more than 400,000 voters, and the spread between Brat and Cantor was about 11 percentage points. So, I think it's tough to make a case that somehow Democratic votes were decisive here.
Frazier,
Jeff, you know. I think it's always interesting to look at someone's history in politics, and you point out that in some ways he was a newcomer to the kinds of things you need to know. If you don't have these instincts, they come to you over time. And if you're not in your district and you don't know your district, you may not see a surge building like apparently it did. It might not be something that would be picked up on the polls. But I wonder what you think about the polling that he had, which he gave to the Washington,
Cantor had, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. which he showed the Washington Post that had him with a 34% lead. You know, I mean, if the poll taker was wrong, it was Cantor's responsibility to point out, well, what about this other thing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what about the things that we're feeling here?
Well, 2 points, I think. One, when politicians start making their polls public, particularly to political reporters, I can't speak for others. It makes me rather nervous. I tend to handle them somewhat gingerly. But beyond this effort at spin by the Cantor forces, a little bit of a primary propaganda, if you will. Primaries tend to attract relatively few voters. And the problem with that is when there are fewer voters, often there are bigger surprises. We saw that in Virginia.
And let's talk about the immigration piece of this. I mean, do you believe that was the linchpin in this defeat? I mean, you gave us three or four factors there, all of them very interesting. But what about specifically Brat on immigration, Laura Ingraham on immigration?
I don't believe that the immigration issue was the deal killer here. I do think that immigration had a number of benefits for the Brat people. One, it was an issue around which all of these national figures, conservative pundits and broadcasters, rallied to the Brat candidacy that gave a lot more personality, additional presence to Brat's campaign. I think, however, the big problem with immigration is that it called attention to Mr. Cantor's this perception that Mr. Cantor is much more interested in gamesmanship than maybe some game-changing shifts in policy. On immigration, it's quite clear that he has tried to find common ground on some of these some elements of immigration, not just to accommodate the White House somewhat, but to accommodate business, which feels very strongly about trying to settle this issue. If only to enlarge a workforce that can be, shall we say, more lightly compensated than the indigenous workforce.
So what did the Tea Party folks, people who voted against Eric Cantor, you think they're reacting to his, I like how you put that there, his thing for his flair for gamesmanship rather than game-changing politics. What was the what's the game-changing politics they want? They want 11 million undocumented immigrants deported? Is that where they are?
Well, there certainly are a number of points that David Brat made as a candidate that appeal to the Tea Party and libertarian voters who turned out in his behalf. But I think if you start to parse that that pool of anti-Cantor voters, you're going to find a lot of people who simply voted against Eric Cantor because they dislike him. And that for the first time, they felt they had an opportunity to act on that.
Was Cantor one of those people that was very worried about voter fraud? I think there might be a bit of irony here. This is a guy that didn't get his own people to vote for him. And meanwhile, his party, at least, is going around worrying about non-existent voter fraud.
Well, I would go back to this challenge of partisan gerrymandering. Cantor and Republicans, and for that matter, a number of prominent Democrats as well, have been insistent on manipulating districts to create certain results. The problem, of course, is you have a system under which the politicians are shopping for their voters rather than voters shopping for their politicians. And I think this has it tends to stunt the skill set of politicians. And Cantor, I think, is a very good example of that. If one only has to rely on the partisan impulse of a district, you know, one needn't worry about communicating, schmoozing, engaging, kissing babies, showing up at community events, you name it.
Go ahead, Frazier.
Well, I mean, you know, it's a cliche now, but all politics is local.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, if you came up quickly and didn't spend a lot of time finding out what your job was, you know, job was to get elected,
right,
then maybe you make mistakes like this.
Well, no one ever said that William Donald Schaefer was ever inattentive, as the politicians say, his knitting. People knew him. They knew where he lived. They knew he lived and worked among them. I can't say that was the impression that a lot of voters in the 7th District of Virginia have about or had about Eric Cantor.
Jeff, just a couple more things here. One is, what's your read on what this means for the Republican Party, for Boehner, the Republican establishment? I know that's a big question, but I'll give you a couple minutes on that. And then secondly, what about the general election up ahead there? Is this Brat's to lose? Maybe...
To your first question,
yeah.
We clearly are seeing in Virginia this Republican v. Republican battle. It is playing out in this state much as it is across the country. What makes it so interesting, or among the reasons it's so interesting here in Virginia, is that Virginia as a whole is becoming an increasingly competitive state, where we're now profoundly purple as opposed to, say, deeply red or deeply blue. So, however this issue is settled within the Republican Party will clearly determine its capacity to compete statewide in Virginia going forward. And competing statewide in Virginia going forward is going to have a lot to say about the ability of Republicans to compete nationally, since Virginia is now very much a swing state.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the general election is concerned, we now have two candidates for the 7th district seat, which includes the Richmond suburbs and reaches out into some of the prettiest countryside you'll ever visit. Both candidates are virgins, newcomers, generally inexperienced,
right,
in this game. So look to them both to go to candidate school, if you will. Long story short, I think the Democrats feel that maybe, just maybe, they could have a shot at this seat. But again, the powerful Republican reflex in the 7th is going to provide an early lift for Dave Brat going forward.
Jeff Shapiro writes about politics for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, a political columnist there. We thank you for spending some time with us today, Jeff. Nice to get to talk to you.
Thanks for including me.
We'll take a break here on Midday. When we come back, more with Fraser Smith, the WYPR senior news analyst, and we'll be welcoming onto the show Linda Hartke, president and CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, to talk about the surge of immigrant children. This is a big story that's actually coming and touching Baltimore now. We'll take a short break on Midday. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here, and we're talking this hour about the politics of immigration reform in the wake of GOP House Majority Leader Eric Cantor's defeat this week in the Virginia primary. We were just doing that with Jeff Shapiro of the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and joining me in the studio today is WYPR senior news analyst C. Fraser Smith. And now I want to pivot a little bit on immigration and talk about the surge of immigrant children that we're seeing in this country. This week, the Obama administration dropped its plans, well, this just happened yesterday, apparently, or the day before, to convert a vacant office building you've probably seen over there on the west side of Baltimore, Metro West, that used to house some offices of the Social Security Administration. They wanted to convert that. There was a plan or talk about converting that into a shelter for immigrant children. And mounting political opposition led by Senator Barbara Mikulski, Senator Ben Cardin said he was opposed to it. The mayor of Baltimore, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, raised concerns about it. So that plan has been shelved, but nonetheless, there's this problem and there's this need still here. There's been a spike in unaccompanied migrants arriving in this country, coming over the border. And as I said at the outset of the show, nearly 10,000 unaccompanied children in the month of May alone crossing the U.S. at the Mexican border and the southwest border. That's a huge jump over the numbers that they've seen in previous years. Joining Fraser and I in the studio, Fraser and me in the studio, is Linda Hartke, president and CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. Linda, nice to have you back on the show.
It's great to be back with you, Dan.
Let's catch up on this, because actually, I guess maybe I haven't been paying attention to this, what's described as a surge. It's called unprecedented numbers of children. What's been going on, and for how long? What do we know?
Children have been fleeing violence and seeking to join family members for many, many years. In fact, Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service has been working with some of these kids now for 9 years. But in the early years, it was maybe 1,000 kids coming in the course of a year, or 2,000, 3,000. But in recent years, the numbers have been doubling or more every year. And what's happening is unparalleled violence in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. That is forcing kids from their home. That is forcing kids and their family members to make terrible choices. Do you stay behind at home where your life is at risk every day, where kids are afraid to go to school or go out of their house because of the drug cartels and the gangs? Or do they try to get to a safe place? And they're choosing, they're making that difficult choice to try to reach a safe place.
So are the children making the choice, or are their parents sending them?
It's a bit of both. You know, I think in as with most cases, parents talk to their kids. And if a child is going to make a journey like this across two borders alone, they're going to have to believe in their heart it's the right thing to do.
Wow. It's an amazing thing to think about. And I've only seen some video and photographs of these kids. They're being held in different federal facilities, right? What are we doing? We're actually capturing them at the border. I use the word capture, detaining them someplace. So where are most of these kids now? Are they along the border somewhere?
So, I mean, first of all, it's important to remember these really are courageous and heroic young people who are making this journey. And they're fleeing their homelands. They're not only coming to the United States. They're going to Mexico. They're going to other bordering countries. They're afraid. And they're at great risk. So they really just are trying to get to safety. The children that are apprehended entering the United States are first taken into custody by U.S. Customs and Border Protection. And some of the stories and the photos are of Border Protection stations overrun with young kids, with hundreds and in some cases as many as 1,000 kids sleeping on concrete floors, which is not a safe place for kids to be. And because the numbers have escalated so quickly, the system is simply overwhelmed. Once a child has initial screening, they are transferred into the custody of the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Refugee Resettlement. The idea is to move them into a safer, more child-friendly setting, whether that's transitional foster care, a group home, or a larger shelter facility, so that then there can be greater care given to the kids, their legal status can be examined, and especially if they have family members in this country, they can be reunited with a loved one.
How old are these kids? I'm sure there's a range, but and how do they get from Guatemala to the borders of the U.S.? I mean, are the coyotes at work again? I'm sure that must be part of it.
That's right. So the kids range from as young as 3, up until 17, just under 18, and of course then they're not considered a child any longer. The kids for many years were teenagers and more heavily boys than girls, but that's changing. Now the average age is getting younger, down to 10, 11, 12 in terms of average, and more girls as well who are fleeing.
Linda, now have any of these children, you said you've been seeing children from these countries for at least 9 years or so, some coming over the border to be reunited with parents who came ahead of them, some being sent here by their parents, but there's this surge that's caused, it sounds like, mostly by violence and upheaval in their country. So are any of them reaching Baltimore through nonprofits such as yours?
Yes, there are children here in Baltimore who are being cared for, and also families who are being reunited with their kids in this area.
Okay, so that's going on, I assume, on a smaller
scale.
Okay, so on the larger scale, the federal government, the Obama administration, is looking for places to better house these children, Frazier, and that's how we get to this story this week about a proposal to use the vacant buildings over in this complex on the west side. That didn't go very far.
Well, you can imagine what the mayor of the city thought and what social service agencies in the city thought. I mean, we're going to be overrun. We're not going to be able to provide the kind of services, safety and security and other things that are going to be
Who would have provided service? Say Metro West was used. I think some of the objections raised were that this is an office building, right? And given what Linda was just saying, describing the detention of these children along the border, this sounds like a luxury hotel compared to but nonetheless, it's just a vacant office building. Barbara Mikulski, the Senator Mikulski, saying that it didn't have the proper infrastructure. I don't know what you thought about that objection, Linda, but I'd like to hear from you on it. Who would have provided services to these children if they were resettled here?
Well, the children who go into shelters, into large shelters, several of them now on U.S. military bases, as well as privately operated shelters around the country, are cared for on site. They're not being released to go out into schools or for medical care. Those services are provided within the facilities where they're cared for.
Okay.
Is an office building the best place to care for children? Probably not. And certainly LIRS is concerned that children are in an appropriate setting, and especially children who faced incredible trauma. There's an immediate need, an emergency need in this crisis to get kids into a safe place and out of border patrol stations.
Well, what do we think of the objections that were raised? But I'm just ask you, Senator Mikulski saying that this building did not have the proper infrastructure, was inappropriate for children. I think Senator Cardin saying something similar, and the mayor. What do you think?
I think
about
it's probably a reasonable concern. I mean, Senator Mikulski's actually been a terrific champion for these kids. She's a social worker. She cares passionately about these issues and for the well-being of children, as do all Americans. So I think her concerns come out of concern for their well-being and ultimately for their longer-term care and success, whether it's here in this country or elsewhere.
Well, and you have the mayor who wants to increase the population of the city by 10,000 families. And one of the reasons I think she thinks that's plausible is that so many families are coming here from this part of this hemisphere. So why wouldn't she be interested in doing it? Well, she might be under the right circumstances, but these seem so rushed that it's just amazing, actually, to think that somebody's actually proposed it. I mean, if you were going to convert Metro West.
They consider it an emergency situation, unprecedented, urgent humanitarian situation.
Well, so then that just means shelter, because that's all you're going to be able to. I mean, if you could provide that.
Yeah. I would like to know how our listeners feel about this. This story sort of came and went in a week, but the story is still here. The problem is still here. The need is still here. What do you do in a situation like this? I mean, we have a sort of humanitarian responsibility. These children are here. What are we going to do with them? How do you send them home? How do you send them back to a place they don't consider safe? I'd like to hear from our listeners about this. 410-662-8780. You probably heard this story. It was proposed this week that the old Metro West complex, the federal complex, be used to shelter some of these kids who are part of this surge. Up to 400 unaccompanied children are crossing the Texas border each day. Most of the children coming from Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala. They're being held in overflow facilities along the border. The federal government is trying to relocate them to different places, not just Baltimore either, right? There's other places in the country that have been proposed, Linda.
That's right. And in fact, new facilities have already been opened just within the last couple of weeks. An abandoned Air Force base in Texas, part of a military base in California is being utilized, Oklahoma as well. So again, it's a rapid move with coordination from FEMA. Because it is a humanitarian crisis on our doorstep to provide safe places for these kids initially. Of course, our concern will be their longer-term well-being.
Well, and one hates to say it, but in a sense, you're being held hostage in a situation like this, because who wants to turn away
children.
Kids?
Yeah, right.
And so you imagine that the kids are being sent here because the assumption is that they will not be turned away and that they will not be not cared for.
Being held hostage by your set of your principles, basically, right? Right?
Yes.
I mean,
you have
a humanitarian obligation, a moral obligation.
Right.
I want to add a technical question for you, Linda. Then we're going to talk a little bit about the politics of this. The term refugee, are these? That seems like a legal term to me. I think it is under our federal law. Would these children be considered refugees, and does that provide any particular legal status for them?
Well, at this stage, they've not been recognized as refugees. Certainly, the United Nations has been making a case based on their research of the root causes that are driving children to flee, that there are valid protection claims for many of these children under international humanitarian law, and that in fact, they should qualify for protection. The U.S., of course, makes its own determination over who it admits as refugees to this country. As a country, we've been blessed and strengthened by the arrival of refugees, generation after generation, who are incredible assets in our communities. But it's a combination of both humanitarian need and political priorities by which the U.S. determines who they admit as refugees. And at this point in time, our State Department is not recognizing sufficiently, I believe, the crisis in these three countries.
Our phone number here for Midday is 410-662-8780. Dan Rodericks here along with Linda Hartke, President and CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. We're talking about the surge of immigrant children, unprecedented, says the White House, coming across the border, what to do with them. It was proposed that some of them be sheltered here in Baltimore at a empty federal facility, federal office building on the west side of Baltimore. That plan has been shelved for the time being, but the problem still exists. We'd like to hear from you on this. 410-662-8780, the email address for Midday. You can pose a question or comment by email, midday@wypr.org. And then to the subject of immigration reform, back into Congress, and we have to talk about this great unresolved issue that we have facing the country here. Certainly is a political flashpoint. Immigration reform, we can't seem to get any place. Those who thought there was going to be some progress now have Eric Cantor was a part of that. Now Eric Cantor will not be a part of that. We'll talk about this when we get back. Fraser Smith joining us here in Studio A. We'll be right back. Just to clarify a little bit here, or sort of separate out the issues a little bit. We have, of course, the political issue of Eric Cantor's defeat, his defeat being linked, at least in part, to his compromising or equivocating on immigration reform in Congress and the right not being very happy about that. A couple of talk show hosts in particular riding that issue against Eric Cantor to his defeat in the primary in Virginia this week. So we have that. Then we have the issue of the surge of immigrant children coming across our borders and the Obama administration trying to do something about them, to house them better than they're presently being housed, a proposal to put them in a, some of them anyway, in a empty federal office building on the west side of Baltimore. That plan has been shelved for the time being in the face of mounting opposition, political opposition from our congressional delegation and the mayor of Baltimore raised issues about it. And then we have just the ongoing issue of immigration reform and whether that's going to happen. And now with Cantor out of the picture, Linda Hartke is with us from Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. I haven't asked you for your political analysis of this, but how important was Cantor to this? Were you looking at Washington and thinking, well, maybe something is going to happen here this year? Because there was the Senate plan, but of course that was going nowhere in the House except for, you know, a little bit of give and take on the part of Cantor, enough to get him in trouble, I guess, with the right. So is that your read on it? Is that what was happening?
I think that's right. I do think there are two things that the American people observe consistently, especially in the public opinion polling that's done, and that's they're disappointed that nothing's happening in Congress. And secondly, they believe immigration reform is important for the future of this country. And those two things aren't going to shift until Congress starts working and addresses the problem of comprehensive immigration reform. Whether that happens this year or in the future, it will have to happen.
Frazier, if the Republican Party moves further to the right, if that's possible, because that's sort of the signal we're getting out of the 7th District in Virginia, when is that going to happen? Is that ever going to happen? If Republicans even get control of the Senate and the House, are we going to see immigration reform without deportation of 12 million undocumented immigrants?
Well, it looks like that part of the political spectrum has its heels dug in on this. And even if it's only part of the reason for Eric Cantor's defeat, I mean, even if he basically lost because he lost touch with his community in general, not just on something like this, well, it certainly doesn't help prospects, you'd have to say.
No, it's not something. Right. I can't hear other candidates talking much about this, or if they do, speaking to the chorus that wants to see wholesale deportations. Or, you know, we've had a lot of deportations anyway under the Obama administration. I'd like to repeat this. It's something like, it's gone beyond 200,000, has it not?
That's right. It's a record number of deportations in the history of the country.
Yeah. Yeah. You sort of wonder why he moderated his position at all. I mean, this is a guy, as we heard earlier from Jeff, who is constantly positioning himself. What did he see coming that made him think it would be smart to take a position that seemed almost moderate, at least in relatively moderate.
How about changing demographics of the United States of America?
Well, people have been urging the Republican Party to do that since the last election, and they seem determined not to do it.
Let's take some phone calls. If you have comments or questions, please speak right up. 410-662-8780. The first call we'll take is from Alan in Baltimore. Alan, thank you for calling Midday.
Thank you very much. How you doing today?
Okay.
Yes, my comment about the subject you guys speaking on, I happen to be one of the kids that sadly had to flee from my country. And, you know, as I was listening to you guys speak, I couldn't help but to share my opinion with that we love our country. We wouldn't want to leave our country, but the way the system is set up, it holds us back. The poverty and the way, the dangerous way how we live, it gives us no other choice but to move out, but to move somewhere where it's finally safe, where we can earn an honest buck and not having to look side to side, being afraid that some gangbanger is going to take it away from us, or even worse, that if we don't recruit their gangs, they're going to kill us. That's not something that us as Hispanics and as of immigrants, we don't have to live that here in the United States. Even if we live here afraid, even if we have problems with language, with anything, we're hard workers, and we only wish to come here and bring our families to a place that we know it's safe and that we can live a better life, a place that is not going to hold us back when it comes down to resources, education, and technology.
Alan, how old are you?
Me, I'm 20 years old.
How old?
20 years old, sir.
20 years old. Okay. And where,
yes, sir.
And where are you from?
I'm from Colombia.
And how long have you been in the U.S.?
I've been in the United States for about 9 to 10 years, sir.
Okay. And you came with your parents, or did you come alone?
I came with one of my parents, and a few years later, I was able to, help my grandmother come to this country.
And I'm just curious, you came into the country legally, illegally? What is your status, Alan?
My status right now is legally, sir.
You have legal status.
But I'm, yes, sir.
I appreciate you calling. Why did you say you left Colombia? Because, what, your parents wanted to protect you from gangs? Or is that what it was?
Sir, not only gangs, but I'll explain to you about most of the cases in us Hispanic countries. As kids, the drug dealers or drug lords or even local gang neighborhoods, they come to us young kids and they offer us the opportunity to join their gang. But when they say offer us, we really don't have much of a choice. Mm-hmm. We really can tell them no, or the next thing is our family is going to be threatened. We can't even get a nice pair of shoes and walking down the street without having the fear that one of these gang members is going to come and snatch them right off my feet, And that's something that I don't have to fear that here in the United States. That's the reason why I feel a lot of people that come to this country, that's one of the main reasons, just to be safe.
Okay. Alan, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate hearing from you. Have you heard a story similar to this, Linda?
Oh, sure. There are hundreds, in fact, thousands of stories like this.
You said over the years, mostly you've seen young men coming across the border.
That's right. So just listen to this short quote from Kevin in Honduras. My grandmother wanted me to leave. She told me, if you don't join the gang, we'll shoot you. If you do join, the rival gang will shoot you, or the cops will shoot you. But if you leave, no one will shoot you.
And that was, you said,
that was a grandmother
in Honduras?
The grandmother of Kevin from Honduras. Yeah.
And as somebody who came to you for service?
That's right.
Linda Hartke is President and CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. An email comment from Steve in Baltimore. He says, let's assume that this particular building at Metro West is not suitable as a youth shelter. But nobody can deny that the plight of the unaccompanied immigrant youth is a very serious problem. Who does have a solution? If not here, then where? A couple of other sites in Maryland have been proposed. I think were proposed even by Senator Mikulski. But anyway, Frazier.
Well, the whole city is filled with buildings that have been refitted and made into apartments that used to just be offices.
That's true.
So, at one point, at least, it wasn't a completely off-the-wall idea.
Right. You'd have to do some work before you moved them in. But on an emergency basis, it doesn't work. But maybe you might need these. Who knows for how many years you might need facilities like this, but not everybody's so cracked up on the idea of accommodating even the children. But let's hear from some of our callers on this. Karen in Baltimore, how are you?
Hi, I'm fine. I'm a little bit embarrassed and ashamed to even express my opinion, especially after listening to that very pleasant and well-spoken young man. But I have a kind of a unique perspective because I'm a nurse. I'm in my upper 50s. I trained in California. I worked as a pediatrics nurse for about 10 years before I moved to Baltimore. And, to me as a nurse, every human being has value. However, when I was a young nurse in California, I said, well, as long as we provide services for people, of course they're going to come across the border. I think it was Milton Friedman, the famous economist, said if you have a welfare state and open borders, then you're going to have this illegal immigration problem. And I hate to say it, but if we make it attractive for people to leave, and look, I know there's a lot of suffering out there. I know that these people are not coming just so that they can have a cell phone. They're coming because life is so terrible. But I have, as a nurse, both in California and in Baltimore and also in New York State, have taken care of patients who have had months to years of care that is not reimbursed, except because they're legal aliens. I had a patient at the hospital I work at now who was on my unit for about 8 months. And where does it end? And it's a terrible thing for me to say this. I never would have thought in my 20s, 30s I would say things like this. But we have so many people here who are not getting what they need, you know. And as long as people over there on the other side of the border say, well, look, you know, Americans are so soft-hearted and so wonderful, and we are, but we're just running out of resources over here for the people who are already here. And of course, you know, it's a natural human inclination to keep sending people over. But I think we have to sometimes, you know, look at both sides of it. So I would never say don't take care of these children, but I guess that's what I'm saying. I'm saying if we make it easy for them to come, not easy. If we, you know, if I was a mother in Guatemala or Colombia, I'd be doing exactly the same thing probably. But I don't know what it's a terrible moral ethical issue, but I'm not inclined to make it any more attractive than it already. I guess what I'm saying, the bottom line is, I'm not inclined to make it any more attractive than it already is.
Well, Karen, I appreciate you calling to share your view on that with us. Linda, what do you say? I'm sure you've heard people say this before.
Sure, and I really appreciate Karen's thoughts. And even as she observed, this is not easy. It's not an easy choice for kids and their families to make, and it's not an easy situation for them when they get here. In fact, it's not attractive. The idea of sleeping in an old government office building downtown Baltimore, is that what we think kids really aspire to when they think about their future? These are people fleeing for their lives and simply trying to find a place that's safe.
If you can get your mind there to make the distinction between people fleeing for their life and people thinking, oh, the next place is going to be better because they have a welfare state. There's a big distinction there.
That's right. And most people, whether it's these immigrant children or whether it's refugees, they would rather live in their home country. They would rather be with their family, their neighbors, in their own culture, with their own language. It's not their life's desire to move to another country, even though the United States is a great country. And the second thing I guess I would say is that the real solution alongside an emergency response to those that arrive is beginning to try to address some of the root causes that's forcing these kids to flee.
Let's take another call. Albert in Towson, you're on Midday Next. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. It seems to me the root cause of this, these gangs and everything, comes right back to the problem of drugs. And unless we handle that and find a way, the war on drugs has not been successful. So unless we find a new way to handle that problem,
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, that is part of the root problem. The Alan, young man who called us earlier a few minutes ago, mentioned Colombia. You know, and I was thinking of Medellin, of course, and you can cite other countries where it is a problem. But I mean, it is that definitely is complex. I don't know what we do about it except try to arrest the demand for slow the demand in this country for drugs that come up that way through Mexico, through Central America. I guess the root cause that he's talking about is the demand in this country for illegal drugs that feed the gangs, that feed all of these problems. Michael in Baltimore, will go to you next. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I noticed some of the news coverage recently about this in the conservative media has implied, you know, some of what's already been stated, that these kids come here with some false intention of trying to get amnesty or DACA, and from, you know, people I know who work in the field, that's not the stories that the kids give when they come here, but it's more like everything that's already been said. They're just fleeing violence and abuse, and I was just wondering if Ms. Harkey could speak to that briefly. I'll take my question off the air.
Thank you.
And that's right. Most of these kids, they haven't necessarily heard about the DREAM Act. They're just trying to get away and get someplace safe. They're not coming with an easy pathway to citizenship or even legal status in this country, but simply looking for a place to be safe.
Another call right along these lines. David in Hedgesville, West Virginia. David, you're on Midday. Go right ahead, please.
Good afternoon, Dan. I just wanted to mention that I personally know David Bratt and worked with him on the Randolph-Macon Board of Associates, and he's a very hardworking, intelligent man. On this problem we have at the border right now, it seems to be based on the perception that we're going to grant amnesty and entry, and that's driving it. I think we need to have an overall conversation on immigration. We need to decide first, though, is how big a country, population-wise, can we handle? We already don't have enough infrastructure to cover the people we have, and the people that come tend to go to the cities, so anybody that's driven in any major metropolitan area knows that the roads aren't adequate. That's a problem. Global warming's a problem. We have all kinds of problems. So the discussion we need to have first is what our population size should be. The problem down in Central and South America are caused, as your last commenter said, by our drug demand. And maybe it needs to be handled at the State Department level and maybe assistance with that gang problem down there rather than concentrating all around the world. We need to concentrate in our own hemisphere.
David, I appreciate your call and your points, but I would say we've been having this conversation for many years now. George W. Bush was president in 2006, I believe. There was a big compromise plan offered to the Congress to do something about the number of immigrants in the country, illegal immigrants in the country, and about the borders all at one time, and he went nowhere with that, even within his own party. So that goes, how many years ago was that? It's moving on nearly a decade ago soon. So we've had this conversation. We had it when Ronald Reagan was president, and actually there was some movement there. And then the years go by, and we get stumped again about what to do and reach a political deadlock.
Well, we know what the problem is. We know it's very complicated, and we needed some systematic way of addressing it. But if you don't have, I mean, politics are can't be removed from the issue. And when you see the results of the last election and the forecasts for the future, if the Republican Party won't respond to that, I mean, even Cantor apparently decided that there was something more reasonable that could be done.
Right.
And then he loses. So this is the kind of thing that really makes you despair, I think.
I would say, Frazier, we're gonna have to leave it at that, but we should keep talking about it, and we will talk about it another day and follow this story about the surge of immigrant children as well. Frazier Smith is a senior news analyst at WYPR, columnist for The Daily Record. We thank you for being here today. And nice to have you back with us, Linda Hartke, president and CEO of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. Thank you very much for your insights and the information you provided. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
And thank you, everyone, for joining us for Midday today. Hope you enjoyed the show. Have a great afternoon. We'll see you again tomorrow for Midday Friday.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Brian Gilbert, Tyler Downey, and Anna Muckerman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.